Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 34, and today I'm joined by Rob Metcalf, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Colorado at Denver, and graduate, and yet another graduate, of the Pennsylvania State University's Department of Philosophy.
That's right.
Rob's work focuses on ancient philosophy, phenomenology, ethics, philosophy of religion, and the history of philosophy, and he's published widely in those areas. But he joins me today here at Michigan State. We're here gathered for the Ancient Philosophy Society that's happening this week. He has joined me on the Digital Dialogue to discuss his and Mark Tanzer's recent translation of Heidegger's 1924 lecture course entitled The Basic Concepts of Aristotelian Philosophy. And it's a text that has been really important for me in my thinking about Aristotle, and I'm really glad to see it now translated into English. So welcome, Rob, to the Digital Dialogue.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So maybe we could start with what this lecture is, where it is in Heidegger's career, and sort of what led you to translate it, to take that huge project. I know it's
right.
A big project.
Yes, it was. Well, it really is a fascinating lecture course. Heidegger got the job in Marburg in 1922 with the expectation that he would write a book on Aristotle.
Right.
And his famous job talk for that position laid out in outline, you know, what that book would look like on Aristotle. But he never published it. So instead of publishing a book on Aristotle, he published Being in Time. And what you see in this 1924 lecture course is, in a sense, what his book on Aristotle would have looked like. But also you see already in embryonic form, you know, the main concepts of being in time fleshed out. And but also in a way not quite as developed as what you have in Being in Time, and so it's exciting actually to see him working out and formulating in a fresh way the concepts that then take their canonical form in Being in Time.
So what are some of the concepts that are developed in the lecture that you see fleshed out more concretely in Being
right.
in Time?
Right. Well, for example, you know, he. In the lecture course just before Basic Concepts of Aristotelian Philosophy, this is an introduction to phenomenological research,
right.
He criticizes Husserlian phenomenology with its thematic focus on consciousness, and he's anticipating a look at Dasein's being in the world as a richer and more philosophically illuminating focus.
Right.
And you see that developed in Basic Concepts of Aristotelian Philosophy. He wants to flesh out being in the world by analyzing Aristotle's concepts of zoe and psyche. And so what you find here is being in the world already being articulated, but not quite... in the final form that we get in Being in Time.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's so exciting about Heidegger's reading of Aristotle in the 1924 lecture is, and so Being in Time is 1927, right?
Mm-hmm.
So a few years, 3 years before the publication of Being in Time, so
right.
he's, you know, these ideas are well on their way to fruition and Being in Time. But the whole idea of, first of all, Aristotle as a phenomenologist, as a proto-phenomenologist, and second of all, as focused on the nature of language as it articulates, as it expresses the being of beings in the world,
right?
In the world in which they, in the context in which they exist. And that's the thing that was so exciting to me at first reading the lecture. And then reading your translation, which is really, I think, an excellent translation, was the way in which Heidegger attends to the central idea in Aristotle that language is an expression of being in the world.
Right.
And so maybe we could talk for a minute about this notion of concept that he begins with in the lecture, begins with Kant, and then moves into Aristotle. And he goes through these traditional concepts of Aristotle's, ousia and all the other categories, prosteia and everything else. And yet he's transforming the very notion of a concept in certainly the modern idea of a concept.
Right. Yeah, and some of the really exciting material early in the lecture course has to do with his understanding of basic concepts and conceptuality, Begrifflichkeit.
Right.
And he says that, we need to, it's not sufficient to just, set forth basic Greek concepts, but really to dig into the ground out of which these emerge. The lecture course wants to lay out that being in the world is the ground out of which something like conceptuality is possible. Mm-hmm. And so, the most important Aristotelian concepts are to be understood in terms of being in the world. He'll say that, conceptuality already is being in the world in a certain way.
Right.
Albeit, for the most part in an implicit form, but it's something that we can philosophically make explicit.
Right, right. And I mean, in there we have, the reason why I find it so compelling, what he's trying to do with the notion of the concept, is that he's trying to move it away from this modern notion of greifen, of grasping, holding, and manipulating in a certain kind of way. I'm being a bit of a caricature what I'm saying about, but this is sort of the general critique of modern conceptuality, which is that it's an imposition of the subject on that which it encounters.
That's right.
And Heidegger sees in Aristotle, I think he's right about this. I think it's easy to miss this in Aristotle, reading Aristotle from our perspective after the subjective turn in modern philosophy. Because Aristotle does seem to be a systematizer, a categorizer, and it can seem that he's imposing these concepts on the thing, on the appearances, rather than reading them out of the appearances themselves.
Right. Yeah, a part of the lecture course that you and I both appreciate very much is this discussion of logos as address, where Heidegger says that logos means both speaking, but also that which is expressed, and so. Reading Aristotle as a phenomenologist, he wants to understand logos in Aristotle really as the apophainesthai ta phenomena, the self-showing of beings. And so what is significant for him is the way in which beings give themselves to us in concrete basic experiences. And so rather than understanding the concept as something imposed on it, the concept is that through which or that wherein beings give themselves.
Right. I mean, very early on, and I made a note of this looking back on it in preparation for our discussion today, he talks about horismos, a definition, as a kind of logos along the lines of what you are saying. And he says, this is on page 11 of your translation. We'll link to it on the blog. That horismos as logos arises from the fact that the being itself is determined in its being as circumscribed by the peras, or the limit. That definition belongs to logos, is a certain kind of logos, a certain kind of expression, articulation, that arises, is not imposed upon, but arises out of the way a being appears as circumscribed in a certain kind of way.
That's right.
As having a limit and as being related to the limit. And of course, you see there already an anticipation, I guess, of the definition, so-called, of the Dasein in being and time, which has its own limit as an issue for it, right? It's death as an issue for it. This being that has its own being as an issue for it, and therefore that turns out to be in part about its limit.
That's right. Yeah, and, you know, another closely related aspect that comes up in the lecture course is his discussion of telos,
mm-hmm.
and the way in which, you know, he in various parts of the lecture course, he wants to critique this notion that, you know, human beings are present at hand. But actually, the human beings, you know, our own being and the human beings that we encounter, we encounter as having telos. That is, that part of the limit character of human beings is that we're already related to our fulfillment in a whole variety of activities, you know, with death on the horizon, but emerging from birth. And it's that full-bodied temporal character of human beings that is necessary if we are to do justice to how we encounter one another.
Right. No, and I think that that holistic, well, for two things. One is the notion of telos in Aristotle. I've had a little bit of this discussion even with Emma Bianchi on the digital dialogue. Well, I can put a link to that too, because she has a real strong critique of Aristotelian teleology and sees in it a real, you know, a certain kind of patriarchal mode of thinking, and on the one hand I can see her point. On the other hand, I try to always, in my conversations with her and also in my thinking about Aristotle, to think about his teleology from a phenomenological perspective.
Right.
That the telos shows itself in the expression of things, in the way things express themselves,
mm-hmm.
and so it's less a matter of imposing the telos on things, but trying to discern what the end or what the function or what the directionality of each being is by attending to the way they express themselves.
Yeah, and certainly, you know, in our relation with children, we spend a good part of our time relating to our children. You know, you're relating to a being in the direction of a telos.
Right.
You know? It would be unintelligible to make out, you know, how we interact and what sort of solicitude we have with respect to children, were it not for the fact that we're always orienting ourselves toward their telos.
Right. So you mentioned the whole idea of justice and doing justice to our encounters, and this is something that obviously, as you know from looking at the manuscript for the Saying of Things book, the book that's going to be on Truth and Aristotle, my book, that's an issue that really has become critical mm-hmm. to me. And one of the things that I saw in the lecture course was reminding me really of the roots of my own thinking in this regard, is the way that Heidegger recognizes, as you were saying earlier, the phenomenological characteristics of language in Aristotle, and in the vocabulary that I tried to develop in the book, this what I'm calling a legomenology, the need to attend to the way things express themselves as we attempt to do justice to who and what and we are and how we are with them as beings in the world. So I think that opens up a whole new perspective on Aristotle. When you read him from that phenomenological perspective, because he's no longer now the grand systematizer, even though a certain kind of systematicity does emerge. Mm-hmm. If it does emerge, it emerges because he attends to language, and he attends to the logos of things.
Right, and there's this interesting parallel, I think, between Aristotle's methodology and what you find in Heidegger, and always approaching things through the way in which the tradition, in particular the philosophical tradition, has already interpreted those things for us.
Right.
So it was part of his critique of Husserlian phenomenology in you know, this earlier lecture course, Introduction to Phenomenological Research. Heidegger said that consciousness as a thematic object cannot do justice to tradition and the way in which tradition informs from the outset our encounter with things.
Mm-hmm.
So, it, Yeah, so, you know, what you find in the lecture course and in this mirrors Aristotle is a way of doing justice to tradition that already informs how the phenomena show themselves, but allows for a critique of that tradition so that the phenomena can give themselves to us philosophically.
Yeah, well, and I think, you know, there, again, going back to the theme of what are the tropes and concepts in this new robust sense of Begrifflichkeit, are found in this lecture course that then get developed in Being in Time. So you've really given a nice kind of articulation of the notion of thrownness, right? Mm-hmm. That's already, that one could put it in these terms, namely Aristotle took seriously his thrownness by engaging the voices that came before, by engaging the philosophers and thinkers and even common opinion that came before. And in which he, in terms of common opinion, the place, the linguistic context in which he finds himself, and where Aristotle himself says, look, every attempt to say something truly, to speak the truth about something, will get at it to a certain degree. He says this in Little Alpha of the Metaphysics. But it won't get the whole story. But bringing these things together, we'll get closer in Xenophanes. Is kind of, it echoes Xenophanes. We talked a little bit about Xenophanes last night. I know he's a hero of yours, so I thought I'd try to bring him in here.
Right. Shout out to Xenophanes.
Exactly.
I mean, just picking up on the relation to Being in Time once again, one of the things that others have found so illuminating about this 1924 lecture course, and I agree with this, is that Heidegger actually does a much better job here than in Being in Time of discussing our speaking being with one another.
Right.
Because it's really, it's underdeveloped in Being in Time. So being with is an existential structure of Dasein. But, you know, oftentimes it's that discussion is overshadowed by the discussion of Dasein today. Whereas here in the 1924 lecture course, you have Aristotle discussing, you have Heidegger discussing Aristotle's rhetoric.
Right.
And in such a way that he says, you know, being in the world is mainly something found within logos.
Mm-hmm.
So he even says at one point that if you were to reformulate Aristotle's definition of human beings as zoon, logon, echon, you'd say something like a human being is a living thing that reads the newspaper. And
that's on page 74. I read that earlier yesterday on the bus, and I underlined it, and I can't believe you brought it up. That was not planned.
It's a great line, and he glosses it by saying that you know, human beings live in discourse.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that, I think, is something that he's fleshing out much more here in the lecture course than you get in Being in Time.
Right. And I think he does, and in this, particularly in that section that you're referring to where he says that, that's also close to one of my favorite lines of the whole lecture course, which is that, this is on page 80, we're better off since we possess Aristotelian rhetoric rather than a philosophy of language. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that's right, because Aristotle did not see a philosophy of language as something that one could extricate from the way in which philosophy happens anyway, and the way in which we exist in any case. So what Heidegger does in his reading of the rhetoric is to take that seriously, to take the fact, as you just put it, and as Heidegger himself puts it, that the Greeks recognize that that human beings exist in discourse.
Mm-hmm.
That we are, as he also says it at another spot in that same area, the Greeks, were serious about the possibility of speaking.
Yeah.
And so we don't see language as an over, or at least according to Heidegger's reading of the Greeks, that language is not something that lays over things, that's imposed upon them, but that grows out of the way things express themselves. So that's why in my book, I try to spend some time unpacking the notion of logos, that not as something that's that is a human imposition on things, but right. as something that belongs to everything, that articulates itself in every way, in any way.
That's right. You know? Yeah, and he even says that, I think it's it really echoes the point you're making here, that logos, speaking, is a fulfillment of our everyday engagement with things, our concernful dealing with things, and that can only be the case if if logos is not something imposed from the outside, but it grows organically out of our relationship.
But that also means, and this is related to some of the themes of the podcast and also of my other research, it means a certain kind of attentiveness. It means being able to respond in certain kinds of ways and to listen as much as to actively speak. So this active-passive dichotomy that we often fall into in modern thinking is really problematized and undermined in a good way, I think, by certainly Aristotelian thinking, and Heidegger recognizes this.
Yeah, and that is another thing that I would just bring to people's attention, that Heidegger does focus on akuin, hearing, listening, as something essential to Aristotle's phenomenology here in the lecture course.
Right. Yeah, and of course that's also an interesting dimension, an important dimension of being in time, right? Where hearing and attending and listening to the call of conscience and all of that becomes really critical, as also a critique of a kind of visual model of cognition that is running through the history of metaphysics, to use Heidegger's kind of language.
Yeah, I hear you.
Yeah, hear what you're saying. And that's why we do a podcast, so people can hear. We have no visuals on this, although we will try and take a picture. We'll get the visual. We got to do a shout out to the visual as well.
We have to gorgify.
Right, exactly. We'll need to figure out about. Well, anyway, the other senses are. We'll have to leave out for now. Although there's a great essay in the beginning of George Santayana's Dialogues in Limbo, when he's talking about Democritus, and he talks about philosophers having a smell, and there's a whole huge. I'm not saying anything right now about this context.
Difficult to interpret, but.
Exactly. So maybe we could talk a little bit about the challenges of translation and what sort of. That's a daunting task. I mean, it's hard enough just to read it in the German and understand it, let alone try to turn it into some readable English.
I'm still daunted. Fortunately, it was actually quite enjoyable to translate with my colleague Mark Tanzer, because we would get together and each make a stab at things, and oftentimes he would have a better rendering of this, whereas I would of another aspect, and so we really were able to, make use of the best contribution that each could give to the translation. And I think the real trick, though, is given that I do read Heidegger as an extraordinary language philosopher, you want to preserve that extraordinary character of his writing, while making it something readable in English.
Right.
You don't want to over-translate and to turn it into something that it isn't. So in German, it's often jarring.
Mm-hmm.
It he doesn't fail to surprise you,
right.
to use ordinary words in extraordinary ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a real trick to be able to do something like that in English, and I think there are moments when fortunately we are able to capture it, and other times you have to go with the least problematic of options, but in any case it was also philosophically fruitful to work through the translation, because I have to say, Heidegger really pushed me and made me attend to the Aristotelian text in ways that I hadn't before So it's really, you know, working on a translation is itself philosophically challenging, right. You know, quite apart from just the, you know, the narrowly translation aspects of it.
Right. So did you, just in terms of some practical, I'm always interested in how different people do it. You say you both sort of tried, you said, okay, we're going to do this passage and try to get this page done or this maybe sentence done at a certain point. And you both sort of, then you came together and you looked at them together. Did you keep a running list of the way you translated certain words, or were you insistent on translating the same word the same way in all contexts? I mean, how did you make those kinds of decisions?
Well, both Mark and I wanted to. Well, we prioritized consistency of translation, and what that meant was that then, you know, as you get further into a text, you start rethinking how you had, you know, how you had begun translating certain key terms, and we'd have to go back and revise when we had, you know, rethought some of the more important concepts. But we did have to keep track of these things, and you know, it was a bit agonizing, maybe too strong a description, but it was definitely very challenging, and it's something that requires going over it again and again.
Right.
And there are things now. I mean, it's only been out for less than a year now, but there are already certain lines that I would do a bit differently, just because it's a, you know, your thinking about it changes, you know, as you come back to it and you think, well, you know, I might have rendered it
right
this other way. But.
Right. So what were some of the, I mean, can you recall, I don't want to put you too much on the spot, but can you recall some, you know, were particular terms or particular concepts that were causing you a lot more headaches than others, or certain decisions that you felt like you had to make that you maybe, even if you wouldn't make them differently, what were some of those issues?
Well, there were times when Mark and I would just disagree about, you know, how we would do certain, you know, important concepts in Heidegger. So Das Mann is a good example.
Right.
He is allergic to the English translation of the they.
He, Mark.
Yeah, right. In a way that...
Because Heidegger is pretty much allergic to all English translations, I would imagine.
He is, especially Americanized English.
Right, exactly.
He, Mark Tanzer, is allergic to Das Mann, or, you know, the they is an English rendering of Das Mann in a way that I am not, and we ended up going with the one for it, which right. makes sense. Though, you know, we talk to Heideggerians about these different translations, and you'll get, you know, a wide variety of opinions. But I think one challenging area of translation has to do with the Umgang and Umsicht that you find here in the lecture course and also in Being in Time, because Umgang we ended up rendering as dealings, our dealings with the world, Umsicht as looking around, although, you know, circumspection.
That's what McCurry and Robinson do, right, in Being in Time.
A circumspection is a possibility. It's a literal rendering,
right.
since you're looking around, circum. But circumspection also suggests a kind of cautiousness, or, you know, when we speak of someone being circumspect. And that's not what Umsicht is. Mm-hmm. Although, you know, Heidegger also relates it to phronesis. So he thinks of the phronimos as one who is able to look around, who's able to, you know, have this Umsicht. Now, that is, what is that? Well, it's a kind of awareness, almost like a peripheral awareness or an attentiveness, you know, you might say, to the situation. And that certainly is true of the phronimos. How do you say that in English? It's it's extremely
with one term.
Yeah, it's extremely difficult to say that. And I think, you know, looking around is it doesn't quite get it. Circumspection also doesn't quite get it.
Looking around is probably, well, I mean, I was going to say is probably too unintentional or too weak in the sense that it does seem like Umsich has a deeper level of awareness. When you go, you sort of look around the room. Okay, that's one thing. But this is actually, on the one hand, maybe I'm going to take that back a little bit, because on one hand this Umsich is happening all the time in the background.
Yes.
Right. So even though it may come to awareness in a thematic way at a certain point.
Right.
Particularly when you're trying to figure out, well, how did I know that was happening? There is an attentiveness to the situation that happens with the practically wise person with the phronemos, who, and if you press the person, well, how were you aware that this was the right thing to do? Well, they probably would be able to step back and say, well, I kind of had a sense of the situation. Right. And again, looking is not the only dimension of this, even though in German, as in English, when you say looking around, it has the visual.
Right. Yeah, that's...
we're translating again.
Right. That's just one indication of how difficult it is to render these pregnant German words into English. And also, I mean, you're triangulating in a way, because Heidegger is pointing to the Greek as well. And so, what about phronesis really brings to mind Umsicht, a kind of looking around or circumspection or awareness, attentiveness to the situation. Another good example is praxis, and the way in which Heidegger wants to understand praxis in terms of besorgen, concern.
Right.
Concern suggests something a bit too mental, too much in your head, whereas praxis really has to do more with your dealings. So it's Umgang that is the object of besorgen, or these concernful dealings with the world.
Right.
That is how he's glossing praxis.
Well, two things. One is that this points to the importance of always reading translations with the original in the background, and then also the importance of having discussions about these terms, because really the meaning of these terms and understanding these terms come out in having more substantive discussion about, why this translation, and, why this term, what's Heidegger trying to really point to with the... With that term, but maybe we could back off the translation discussion for a second, because you're bringing up this notion of praxis, it actually brings me to an issue which I would love to just have a little discussion with you about, which is sort of Heidegger's reading of poiesis in this text versus praxis, and sort of that whole constellation of poiesis, techne, praxis in this early Heidegger, has always been something that, and also in Aristotle, has always been something that's been a really tangled web of terms that sort of in certain kinds of way flow into one another. So on the one hand, I think I've tried myself to disentangle them to some degree in Aristotle, because a praxis, at least in the Metaphysics, in Book 9 of the Metaphysics, where he lays out the difference between a praxis that has its end in itself, that is a complete action, versus a motion which it has an end outside of itself, and maybe that's where we should focus our attention for a minute, because kinesis becomes, at the end of the lecture course, really critical. And it's really that difference between kinesis and praxis, and the way Heidegger, I think, wants to bring them together in Aristotle, and the way, actually, they do come together in certain ways in Aristotle.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there is this interesting distinction that is made, certainly in the Metaphysics, between a kinesis which is sort of incomplete, which is, so long as you are, let's say, as an example, if you're exercising to lose weight, let's do it this way, you're walking to a destination, you're walking, so long as you're walking, you're moving, and moving is happening. Once you get there, you stop moving. The motion, at least in regard to that particular end, is over, because and the end remains outside of itself, whereas a praxis always has its end in itself. And yet Heidegger continually wants to come back to Aristotle's analysis of kinesis as the core for much of what Aristotle is doing and much of what Aristotle is thinking about. And I think that we can't have the notion of kinesis as a production, as a poiesis with its end outside of itself, when you really take kinesis seriously in the way Heidegger is trying to do.
I actually think that your thoughts on this matter are much more interesting than what I could contribute. But certainly, I also see him in the lecture course trying to understand our temporality,
right,
in terms of kinesis. And it's, now of course, there's an Aristotelian inspiration for Heidegger's discussion of Dasein's temporality, so that, you know, happiness cannot be said of a moment in a life, it's said of life as a whole.
Right.
And so if you're going to understand, you know, human flourishing, the good that we are striving to achieve, you have to think of a human life, you know, across its, you know, from beginning to end,
mm-hmm,
as a movement in that sense. And so, so I understand kinesis as really pointing in the direction of Dasein's temporality. And that's different in a way. It's different in character than, you know, understanding kinesis and in the particular examples that you brought up. But.
Well, yeah, and I think this is an issue, a larger issue, because I think the Heidegger also has an account of poiesis,
mm-hmm,
that is not bound to the traditional notion that its end is outside of itself,
mm-hmm,
because he wants to see, and I think he develops it toward the end of this, poiesis and also pathane, right, as together,
mm-hmm,
this active productivity and passive, you know, passion or whatever,
right,
as belonging together. And so once you begin to do that, I think it's good, it's important to do that, but once you begin to do that, from my perspective, you're into a discussion really of a kind of praxis, if you take praxis really as having its end in itself and not being a purely active activity, but also an activity that has a dimension of hexis and a dimension of,
right,
of passivity that's not purely passive. So there's a middle voiced activity.
Yeah, you know, his discussion of the pathe in the lecture course is, you know, some of the most important and most influential you know, parts of the lecture course. And he says at one point about the pathe that they are the ground out of which speaking arises, and which what is expressed grows back into.
Mm-hmm.
So that, so yes, it is the case that logos relates to pathe as ground, but it's also the case that we form the pathe, or we contribute to the forming of pathe into dispositions.
Right.
And if you're going to develop your account of logos and pathe in this way, then really you are talking about praxis. You're,
mm-hmm,
talking about you know, lifelong discursive practices, mm-hmm, which you know, inform our attitudes, you know, inform how the world matters to us.
Right. And what he's talking about there, too, is the importance of cultivation.
Hmm.
So on the one hand, we are taking things up in certain kinds of way. We are thrown into certain situations, but we're also cultivating dispositions.
That's right.
Right. And that's really a part of what I'm really interested in the work that I'm trying to do with the podcast, and also with thinking about what Socratic politics might mean, and also how we now might respond to some of these technological developments and what it's doing to education and our ability to communicate with one another and with the world in general. ways we are taking up these technologies such that they become dispositions directed toward justice, questions of justice, questions of the good, mm-hmm. questions of the beautiful, and what's the extent to which we're being taken up by these technologies in ways that are making it more difficult to turn our logoi toward questions of the good, questions of the just, questions of being together in ways that are fulfilling and meaningful, and also I think responsible to the environment, to the world as such. So I think that notion that things express themselves and have an impact on us, and in our response we return them to that ground from which other habits and other, I would just use the Aristotelian terms, hexes, because I don't, habit seems too passive, right? These are cultivated active conditions of the soul, to use, you know, an overwrought translation, but probably a better one than just habits.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, there's one point in the lecture course where he glosses hexes as being on the alert in one situation, and that's possible only by way of, you know, cultivation of the pathe. And so your habit is too weak, you know. And if you simply translate hexes as habit in the Aristotelian text, then you're missing some of that important context that Heidegger's trying to bring out. On the issue of technology, right now in my Heidegger course, we're reading the essays on technology, the Bremen lectures from 1949. As well as a question concerning technology, building, dwelling, thinking.
Right.
And I think it's illuminating that Heidegger returns again and again to the Greek context for thinking about technology, the way the Greeks understood techne, and his insistence, throughout these lectures and essays on freedom and the way in which humans themselves participate in the dangers of technology points to something like the possibility of our, directing technology toward human flourishing. Mm-hmm. So,
I think just to draw on that point, in the question concerning technology, he's pretty clear to trace the origins of techne to a certain kind of poiesis, and that he associates with bringing forth that which doesn't come forth on its own as it does in phusis,
right?
In nature. And there, if we can trace continually remind ourselves that what technology is about in part is about bringing things forth that weren't, bringing forth possibilities that weren't there, we can begin to recognize that, okay, these possibilities are not value neutral. They are, and we are involved with them, these technologies, in ways that determine the technologies, even as the technologies are determining us.
Right.
So that this relationship between, what's happening with a podcast when you're listening to it versus reading a book or having a face-to-face conversation, what's going on with all of the masses of information that you're having to deal with, and how we're responding to them, and how we're developing other tools that will allow us to deal and handle them differently, right? So the technology is always being redetermined in the face of the kinds of impacts that it has. And I think, part of the point that I always come back to is, and this is for my own perspective, my own approach is to use a lot of these technologies because I see possibilities in them that I didn't see in just thinking about them. Actually, because, using, let's say, a certain... the one example that comes to my mind right now is the Twitter. Right, at first I thought Twitter was just ridiculous, and as I started using it and realized that, we had a conversation briefly about this yesterday, that actually what it's doing when I'm following certain kinds of people, as I do as associate dean with following some of my Penn State students, is that now I'm all of a sudden linked into a conversation that about what was happening on the Penn State campus that I wasn't, that I really didn't even anticipate was going to happen when I started using the technology. And which isn't to say that there are not limits and other problems with it. But the point really from my perspective is it's in the using, it's in the practice, it's in the having it be part of your way of interacting with others that you learn the possibilities and also the limits of that.
Yeah, and bringing back the discussion to, our living in discourse.
Right.
What's interesting about these technologies is the way in which they impact our being with one another in discourse. I find that one of the most important effects of this lecture course of Heidegger's on Aristotle is that he brings back our attention to Aristotle's rhetoric, which is really a neglected work,
right,
in the Aristotelian corpus. And but rereading the rhetoric, it is it goes right to the heart of our being with one another in discourse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how it's not just in terms of context of persuasion, though that is, one of the most important parts of the rhetoric. It's also, it addresses the context or the community of interpretation. You know, how
right.
are we to be with one another open to different interpretations? You know, what sort of dispositions must we cultivate in order to be good theoretical participants,
mm-hmm.
Participants in an interpretive community, whether that be, a political, in terms of political discourse, philosophical
right.
discourse, what have you.
Right, right. Yeah, I just point to the passage on page 79 of your translation where it talks about rhetoric. He says, rhetoric as such does not have the task of pasthai, of persuasion. It does not have to cultivate a definite conviction about a matter to set it to work with others. Rather, it only sets forth a possibility of discourse for those that speak insofar as they are resolved to speak with pasthai as their aim, with persuasion as their aim. So this is sort of, this directedness and having your words be directed and is the critical dimension of this. But I wanted, so it occurs to me now that if Heidegger says, on as you had quoted before, the human being is a living thing that reads a newspaper, maybe what we're talking about now is the human being is a living thing that surfs the web and that interacts with one another through the logoi that are often digitally mediated through digital means. But yet it's still logos, and it's still expression, and it's still about being with in new and different ways.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think that, another way of saying that, a human being is a living thing that reads the newspaper, is that a human being is a living thing that lives in media.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That we, we're constantly in the context of all sorts of different media, digital, written,
right.
and so on.
Right.
But what does that mean? That means that we are with others in persuasive context, but also in a community of interpretation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that really brings, the nice thing about putting it in those terms is that you see the continuity between the movement, let's say, from the oral tradition to the written tradition, creation of books, the movement of the printing press, and it's no wonder that humans, as beings with logos in a certain kind of way, have come up now with yet a more expansive way to be discursive, with the creation of the internet and with the ability now to connect with one another in a very dynamic way that brings with it, just as Socrates was worried in the Phaedrus about what happens when writing happens, what happens to memory when writing comes, it brings with it things that are lost, right?
Yeah.
But other things are gained, and my interest, and this goes to the purpose of the podcast and also the interest in some of the ideas presented in the lecture course of Heidegger's, is are we cultivating in ourselves those active conditions of the soul, those abilities to be attentive with one another, that will allow us to make our lives meaningful, to direct our lives and to direct our encounters with one another toward something like the good or toward the question of justice?
Well, I mean, definitely the way you just said that, it seems that for me really is the heart and soul of teaching,
right.
You know, because we're not disseminating information as, you know, one might think. It really is, it's a matter of turning the soul, right. You know, in the great image of the Republic, but where, you know, what direction the soul should be turned in is part of that very turning of the soul.
Right.
So
right.
It's a living in the question and the questioning of what exactly are those active dispositions of the soul
right.
that we should be cultivating.
Right. And I think as teachers, we're learning as well. So, I mean, I think that's a critical part of that. Maybe we can end just on this. I know that this was a lecture course that he gave, and there were some pretty famous people in that course. Who was in that course? Do we have?
Gadamer was in the course, and you know, recently there's been some interviews published recently of Gadamer before he died, where he you know, talked about how influential this course was for him,
mm-hmm.
and the beginning of his own writings. So in particular, Heidegger's turn toward rhetoric and Aristotle.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, the students that were there in the course, it was held, I think it was at 7 a.m. that he held this course 4 days a week. And so students, Gadamer tells us, would meet after the class to kind of wake up and scratch their heads and what in the world is going on. It's an amazing lecture course, in part for the intensity, you know, that this passionate intensity that Heidegger brings to the study of Aristotle and in the wee hours.
right.
So it's really, really a fascinating work for those who haven't read Heidegger before, but who are interested in ancient philosophy. I think it's a good entryway into Heidegger, because you can at least, you know, take a look at his own renderings and his own meditations on Aristotle, you know, whatever else you do with Heidegger's thought.
Yeah, no, and I agree with that, and I would definitely recommend people picking up a copy of this. It's nice to there's a way in which that, because it's anchored in the Aristotelian text, you do have a toehold in a way that you sometimes don't feel like you have in a text, like a giant text like Being in Time.
Right.
You can sort of always come back to try and see what the Aristotelian texts were like. Now, of course, getting a toehold on the Aristotelian text is also not that easy, but it's definitely a good introduction to some of the thinking of Heidegger, and certainly critical to understanding what's going on in Being in Time. So thank you, Rob, for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me on Digital Dialogue.
Great. The Digital Dialogue is produced under a Creative Commons non-commercial share-alike license. To download or subscribe to The Digital Dialogue, visit iTunes U at the Apple iTunes Store and search on Digital Dialogue. You'll find it under the Pennsylvania State University area of the iTunes Store. You may also visit my website, The Long Road, at www.personal.psu.edu/CPL2. Or you can join us on Facebook by becoming a fan of The Digital Dialogue on our Facebook page. Just search Facebook for The Digital Dialogue. This has been The Digital Dialogue.